Introduction. Where the Stray Dreams Go. Andy Porter put together this special issue of his science fiction fan magazine, Algol, and he called it the Elish, which meant it had a transcribed and edited version of a speech I'd made at a convention and half a dozen articles by and about me. I can't deny I was flattered and even a little embarrassed by the honor, particularly by the articles Andy had commissioned to be written by Ted White and Lee Hoffman and Robert Silverberg, three friends who have known me both wearily and well for many years. They had remembered things I'd done and things I'd said and places I'd been that I had long since forgotten, and their views of me were more honest than I'd care to admit. Silverbob, in particular, reminisced about an incident that took place in 1953 in Philadelphia. He recalled the episode in which three rather heavy lads braced me for some now-forgotten insult I'd leveled at one of them. Bob wrote, quote, "Any sensible man would have disappeared at once, or at least yelled for the nearest bellhop to stop the slaughter, but Harlan stood his ground, snarled back at Semenovich, nose to nose, and avoided mayhem through a display of sheer bravado, which demonstrated one Ellison trait, physical courage to the verge of idiocy. Unlike many tough-talking types, Harlan is genuinely fearless." Unquote. Courage, to me, is one of those dormant qualities one never knows one possesses until the pressure is applied. I have known many television producers, for instance, with weighty claims to courage who, when the screws were put on them by networks or studios, folded instantly. The one time I made an idol of someone, a man who professed to being a pillar of courage, he turned out to be as weak as any other man when the pressure was laid on him. More the fool me for having demanded anything more of him or of anyone than that they be merely human, with all the attendant foibles and feet of clay. To be courageous when all that is at stake is talk, parlor liberals, take note, or a few dollars, is not to be courageous at all. Hemingway, I suppose, knew where it was at. He was never satisfied with the shape and substance of the courage he found within himself. He continually tested it, setting himself in positions of untenability and danger, merely to find out if the courage was still with him, if it still seemed adequate for the life he was compelled to support. I am for larger and more frequent tests of courage. Not until I was boxed in totally, in situations where there were no other exits than through the mouth of danger, with courage the only weapon, did I satisfy myself that I did, indeed, possess what Silverberg calls courage to the verge of idiocy. Bob has told of one such instance. Avram Davidson may recall yet another. Gay Talese reported on a third. And so I find at 33 that fear and I mix as well as oil and water. It's not that I'm fearless. It is simply that there is nothing I fear. Let me correct that. I am petrified of wearing contact lenses. My brother-in-law, Jerry, attempted once to get me to wear contacts, and when the oculist set a test glass in my eye, the hair went straight up on my head. I wet my pants. The blood drained out of my face, and I was covered with sweat till he got it out. Ridiculing myself for this adolescent behavior, I demanded the oculist try again. He was reluctant, but I insisted. It was worse the second time. I still wear my glasses on the front of my head, and I can say with great certainty that I am afraid of things being put into my eyes. Yet, I do not fear lizards, or drowning, or dark rooms, or rats, or high places, or death, or poverty, or needles, or deep personal involvements, or the wrath of the gods. I choose not to think of this as something deserving of applause. There's no control over it. Just as there is no control on my part of an absence of a time sense, see, repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man. And so it is as lofty an ability as a good bowel movement. Reflex action, Audie Murphy notwithstanding, is not deserving of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Ah, but there is a fear I fear. A major fear, and one that propels me like a .30-06 slug through life. I am desperately afraid I will die before I've written all the stories I have in me. Self-analysis grows chancy, but each man decides at various times in his life who he is, where he's going, what he stands for. Perhaps not in so many words, but in a kind of subconscious codification that enables him to stop the action at any given point and say, this is good, this is evil, this is right, this is wrong. We call it a sense of morality or ethic. We call it a conscience. We call it maturity or a relation to the universe. But whatever it is, even if it goes by the name of love, it helps a man know what his potentialities may be. For some time now, I have been agonizingly aware that I am a talent of considerable dimensions encased in a man of very limited possibilities. The talent that is me and the man that is Harlan Ellison are two very separate and distinct entities. That the man lugs around the talent becomes at once a blessing and a curse. Consider, a woman may find me inordinately involving, and an affair begins. Through it all, through all its stately progressions, I wonder, is it me, or is it the talent she's in love with? Why must it be me, this puny Ellison, that has to carry the talent like Quasimodo's hump? Why cannot this talent be deposited within, say, Cary Grant or Kirk Douglas, or even something that looks like Doug McClure? They're beautiful people. They wouldn't have to be jealous of the talent. Why must it be me that wakes in the early morning because the ideas are fermenting, bubbling up in the mental mire? Why must it be me that has to write television to support the needs of a body that demands comfort and luxury? If it were Steve McQueen, he could write only the great ones and not have to do the slavey labor. And because of this jealousy, this rivalry between the talent that need prove nothing to anyone and the body that is Harlan Ellison that must prove itself over and over again, the treacherous fifth columnist of the body keeps putting the talent in jeopardy, risking its neck, taking dangerous stands, getting involved in relationships that promise nothing but flame out, stretching the abilities to the breaking point. Thus, all the Harlan Ellison stories that are told, all the weird anecdotes, they are the cartoon capers of the pack mule braying for attention, while the stories merely exist without side comment or need for defense. They speak for themselves. They are complete and whole and self-contained. And thus, again, the body that seeks to prove its worth entirely independent of the talent is forced to live with the fear. By subjecting the talent to unnecessary risks, it brings down upon its head the torment and terror of the one big fear that the body of Harlan Ellison will succeed in destroying itself before the talent of Harlan Ellison gets said all it has to say. For the first time, I'm beginning to think Geminis may be schizoid after all. So, to get it all said, to wind out all the stories on silver threads, to relate all the relationships of all the people, each with its own tiny death interwoven with the comedy and shadows. So many stories. They now total over 600, not counting the novels. But what of the ones started and never completed? All the false starts, all the bits and pieces that began well and soured midway through? What of the night flashes that woke me from sleep and toward which I crawled on hands and knees to the typewriter near the bed so nothing escapes even in half sleep? What of those? What of the vagrant thoughts, the stray dreams, the incomplete fractions of ideas? Silver Bob's reminiscences of me and my courage and my subsequent analysis of it all, as set down here rather nakedly, I'm ashamed to say, set me to rummaging through the idea file I keep, that I suppose all writers keep, and I came up with snippets I knew instinctively I would never, ever manage to get into stories. And I was afraid. Afraid they would die, even as bad stories die. But at least they deserve a chance to live, these stray dreams. So, with your permission, let me offer a few of the ones that seem good even after the long periods since they were written. And if any of them touch you, if any of them seem worthy, perhaps you might drop me a line and let me know, and it might stir me to take them up again and order the bones and flesh onto them, making stories of them. And if only one or two come from it, then you will have been an important part of the creative act, and we will both be richer for it. The/one/word/people. There are some that can be met, strange and twisted ones, you know, by an aura, a scent, a feel about them, that if you had one single word like junkie, or nympho, or hooker, or bircher, a key word that labeled their secret bit, you would understand all the inexplicable off-center things about them. Like the girl you meet and start to date who can't see you on Thursday nights but makes weak excuses as to where she goes on Thursday nights. If you had the word diabetic, you would understand that every Thursday, her doctor's appointment keeps her out of circulation, and that's why she doesn't drink and spends long minutes in bathrooms shooting insulin. But she's ashamed. Don't ask why. People do kooky things. So she just has that one soft, foggy spot in her reality, and you wonder what the hell the story is. Or your friend who picks fights with Italians, and aside from not telling you what his real name is, couldn't be a better drinking buddy. If you had the word deportee, you'd understand that he was picked up for anarchist reasons in Italy and deported and is in the country illegally. It's like that. The one-word people. One word, and you've got the handle on them, the motivator of their existence. Adolescent, Puritan, passing, wino, they all do it. Granted, it's a dubious sort of categorization. Still, it works. And like the old wives' poultice of spiderwebs that was laughed at as a remedy for bruises, cuts, and the removal of a mouse under the eye, when a recent medical breakthrough found a cure for these containing many chemical elements found in spiderwebs, it must be concluded that in the final analysis, what works, works. Bringing me to Nicole Shane, spelled S-H-A-H-I-N, pronounced Shane. And she's the fastest gun in the East. Have to be. Shot me down, and I didn't even see her draw. Moth on the Moon. Streeter got so pissed off arguing, he gave me a shove. "One more of those, you ignoramus, and I'll put you in the infirmary," I said. It embarrassed me. Every time I got in a beef, my voice automatically dropped 3 octaves. It was my B-movie villain voice. The unit watch on duty got between us. A medium-sized apple, neither of us would poke him. He'd crumble like a lunar frog's dust dream. A big, ugly piece of furniture like Streeter. A berserker like me when I got hot. "Come on, back off, both of you." He pushed us away from the common center himself. There was enough leverage. I hit one side of the bubble, Streeter the other. Cramped quarters on the moon can do it, drive you up the curve of the bubble every time.
"I'm tired of him copping out for every mistake he makes," Streeter snarled. "And then dreaming up elves and gnomes to take the blame?"
"Don't blame me for your lack of imagination."
"Moth? You're full of shit, friend."
"Is shed number 3 gone, or isn't it?"
"Yeah, gone. So what? How'd you screw it up?"
Come on, it must have been a hell of a sweet move to completely destroy a 3-ton storage shed. What's your story?
It was a moth.
Streeter growled and came for me again. The WOD headed him off at the pass between the CompuVac and the feeder and threatened him with the cooler, so he simmered down.
Now that one takes the prize, Streeter rolled his eyes. A moth, a goddamn moth, for Christ's sakes, on the moon!
Is the shed gone? I asked, quietly, rationally.
Yeah, the shed is gone.
It was a moth. It came swooping down and chewed it up, the entire shed.
Oh, Christ, I give up.
Streeter turned and stumped out of the control bubble. The WOD stared at me a minute. His eyebrows quivered.
Terry, he said softly, report to the medic in 20 minutes. I'll get a relief for you.
He left, and I stared out at the lunar surface for a long time. 20 minutes can be a long time.
It was a moth, damn it.
They're the blinds, he said softly. They were created out of an experiment with self-regenerating cell tissue. They lie flaccid and dormant, just flaps of flesh without eyes or sense organs or souls, until a thought passes them by, and they fasten on it, literally pull themselves hand over hand up that thought.
The old Indian rope trick, Wyckoff thought picturesquely.
Until they've established a form for themselves, they have only one drive. Survival. They'll do anything to keep living, such life as it may be. They'll take any form, anything at all, a man, a cockroach, a gull in the sky, anything that has the faintest tinge of thought in it, even a witless thing like a paramecium, and they build from that. But they'll do anything to stay alive.
The blinds, repeated Wyckoff.
Yes, that's right,
the little fat man nodded. He was perspiring.
You dirty little weasel,
Wyckoff said quietly.
It's both refreshing and discouraging to find out that cowardice hasn't been bred out in this future you're from.
Why, I... You eat worms. Shut up. Let me think, crud.
Speechless, we stand before Van Gogh's Starry Night, or one of the hell images of Bosch, and we find our senses reeling, vanishing into a daydream mist of, what must this man have been like? What must he have suffered?
A passage from Dylan Thomas about birds singing in the eaves of a lunatic asylum draws us up short, steals the breath from our mouths, and the blood and thoughts stand still in the body as we are confronted with the absolute incredible achievement of what he has done. So imperfect, so faulty, so broken, the links in communication between humans, that to pass along one corner of a vision we have had to another creature is an accomplishment that fills us with wonder and pride. How staggering it is, then, to see, to know what Bosch and Van Gogh and Thomas knew and saw, to live for a microsecond what they lived, to look out of their eyes and view the universe from a new angle. This, then, is the temporary, fleeting, transient, incredibly valuable, priceless gift from the genius to those of us crawling forward moment after moment in time with nothing to break our routine but death. How amazed, how stopped like a broken clock we are when we are in the presence of the genius, when we see what his incredible talents, wrought out of torment, have created, what magnificence or depravity or beauty, perhaps in a spare moment, only half trying, he has brought it forth for the rest of eternity and the world to treasure. And how awed we are when caught surprised in the golden web of true genius, so that finally, for the first time, we know that all the rest of it was kitsch. It is made so terribly, crushingly obvious to us just how mere,
how petty, how mud-condemned we are, and that the only grandeur we will ever know is that which we know secondhand from our geniuses, that the closest we will come to our heaven while alive is through our unfathomable geniuses, however imperfect or bizarre they may be. And is this, then, why we treat them so shamefully, harm them, drive them inexorably to their personal madhouses, kill them? Who is it, we wonder, who really still the golden voices of the geniuses, who turn their visions to dust? Who, the question asks itself, unbidden, are the savages, and who the princes? Fortunately, the night comes quickly, and answers can be avoided till the next time, until the next marvelous singer of strange songs is stilled in the agonies of his rhapsodies. Snake in the Mind. Shadows lived in that house, a heavy, somnolent madness that pressed against the inner walls and made the very glass of the dark windows bulge outward as though bloated. Carrie had warned me there was a slithering horror in the place, even before either of us had known for certain I would be coming to town, but I had snickered at her, and rummaging on the bookshelves of my own jolly pad in Los Angeles had tossed the copy of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House at her. "Jackson already wrote it up, Punkin," I laughed. "If you were living in Transylvania or some dark corner of Brittany, I might buy it, but Brooklyn? Come on, kiddo." She'd smiled wanly, looking up at me from the sofa, and there had been a wispy, thin, almost timorous smile on her elf face, brave and quite frightened. "You'll see," was what she left me with. And now, here I was in New York and walking up the steps of the Romaine House in Flatbush. How ridiculous. What a silly-ass place for weirdness in the heart of comfortable mediocrity and middle-class lack of imagination. And I had to admit what she had promised was true. The house was a typical no-style 1920s monstrosity with front porch, attic windows, and dormers at attention, glass-paneled front doors, mail slot silently pursed as though capable of secrets, if only it would speak. But there was more. There was the filtered stink of dust long since gone, of old clothes bundled together, of parchment-skinned hags dead in their apartments with old Life and Newsweek stacks ceiling high, and $40 million in small change under the floorboards, of velour drapes drawn against the sun, of heavy jungle or empty desert, of non-place, of non-time, of aloneness. Poe and Hawthorne and Lovecraft tried to speak of the terrifying desolateness of moors or graveyards or empty stretches of the sea, but for sheer wanton loneliness, there is nothing like a Brooklyn street in late fall, October, November, when the leaves mat like dark coagulated blood in the gutters, and the chill wind spins down through the cross streets, chasing the subway trains like hungry dogs after meat wagons. Empty, chill, helpless. It is the end of the universe, and anyone stupid enough to be caught away from a bubbling TV set or a good 19 broad orgy deserves to stand out there and shiver. Not entirely from the cold. So I walked up the steps and turned the old-fashioned door chime in its metal frame and heard the rasping ring-a-ling of it far inside. The door burst open inward almost immediately, and Carrie, little gnome, was standing there in her Greenwich Village outfit, long hair brushed back in a single braid, her eyes alive, as though I'd come to save her. "Welcome to Dante's Inferno," she murmured. Rudy was a prelim fighter. 1-2, a right cross just under the heart. The mob kept him around for laughs. He was a gentle kid. Rudy did 21 years with the mob, since he'd been 17. But when Rudy was 38, he was a little too old to be called the kid anymore, and he wanted out of the mob. Not for any specific reasons, there wasn't any heat going, but just because he felt restless, had the feeling there were other things to do. Rudy had always heard it said, "Nobody leaves the mob." Yet surprisingly, there was no trouble when he told them he wanted out. Why not? He didn't have anything they wanted or were afraid to turn loose of, especially knowledge. Rudy had been a hitter, and what he knew was old and unimportant. So they gave him a nice bunch of 20s, smacked his back, and said, "So long, Rudy." In this book, everything has been invented except the truth. If there is no truth, there is no book. If there is no invention, there is no book. Who can be offended by the truth? Who can be offended by invention? John Barry, prefatory note to Krishna Fluting. My fingertips are covered with the scars of people I've touched. The flesh remembers those touches. Sometimes I feel as though I am wearing heavy woolen gloves, so thick are the memories of all those touches. It seems to insulate me, to separate me from mankind. I very often refrain from washing my hands for days and days just to preserve whatever layers of touches might be washed away by the soap. Faces and voices and the smells of people I've known have passed away, but still my hands carry the records with them. Layer after layer of the laying on of hands. Is that altogether sane? I don't know. I'll have to think about it for a very long time, when I have the time. If I ever have the time. Acknowledgement. The concept embodied in T's speech, page, is not original. Nor has it been plagiarized. Rather, it is that peculiar melding of originality and plagiarism that occurs, I'm told, in all those of an artistic bent. It was spurred to life by something someone else had written. In this case, Salinger. I was reading Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters, and when I read across the line, "I have scars on my hands from touching certain people," I stopped dead, without going further, dashed into the next room and the typewriter, and wrote T's speech, even before that section of the novel had been drafted. It laid out for me a particularly important facet of his character, a facet, in fact, which planned a direction I had only vaguely till then considered for the book. What that speech did, in effect, was build the very cornerstone of my book, and set my thoughts to considering depths I would not otherwise have attempted in what was originally intended as a straight adventure novel. When I went back and found that Salinger had gone on to say almost precisely what I had said, I felt awkward, small boy kicking turf, embarrassed. I have no doubt no one would consider that I had borrowed in writing that paragraph, for in the main, readers are barely aware of what a writer tries to do with his mechanics. But I would know there was a debt there. And so, this note. It would be safe to say, then, that this novel was strongly influenced by J.D. Salinger. Though I'm certain he would find such an idea presumptuous, it remains true, in a much murkier sense than merely his words triggering my thoughts. Those words opened doors my mind knew were there but had never considered looking beyond, at least in this book. And in that degree, I feel Mr. Salinger has helped make this a worthier effort. My thanks to him. Harlan Ellison, Hollywood, 1963. Pieces of things that will never be written. Where they came from? I choose to remember, for the stimulus is often more memorable and important than the shabby fiction it produces. Where they reside is here, for whatever pleasure or momentary empathy they may cause. Where are they going? Probably no further, for having been set down, they accomplish what they were intended for, a spark gap effect, a bridging of the mind through concepts. By imposing the necessary artificiality of plot and character on them, they become greater than themselves. They become stories. which ought to more than satisfactorily answer, for all time, at least as far as I am concerned, the question raised by drunkards and dilettantes at cocktail parties. Where do you get your ideas? About the stories in this book. Each story has its own little prefatory note by the undersigned, but a few words before you attack them, and as a reviewer has noted, they attack you. For the most part, these are old stories. I would not write them this way were I writing them today. Several of them I find painfully amateurish. This collection was originally intended as a reprint of my first collection, A Touch of Infinity, released in 1960. That's 7 years ago, and most of the stories were written in the late 50s, when I was learning my craft. This is by way of explanation, not excuse. I still stand behind the stories, even though they were written by quite another Harlan Ellison, or a series of Harlan Ellisons. That they are once again in print is due not only to the author's continuing need for money and ego boosting, but to the requests of a large number of readers who have encountered the later works and have made querulous noises about the ones that came before. Due also to the interest of Belmont's lovely editoress, Gail Wendroff, who insisted on including four of the stories from that first collection among these other never-before-anthologized pieces. And to the urgings of my literary agent, Mr. Robert P. Mills, a man whose interest in my career has kept me on numerous occasions from throwing in the bloodied towel. It has been a long way from Courage and Andy Porter and Silver Bob and Raw Strips of Flesh that might and may yet someday be stories. A long way, and yet truly a hyperspace jump. For the journey is made through the mind of the creator, by way of lands without signposts. And if those lands could be named, if they were not the terra incognita in which this author dwells much of the time, it might be seen by the light of revelation that they were right here, all the time. You have been very kind, and I thank you. Harlan Ellison, Hollywood, 1967.